A low turnout runoff election this week in Duval County. Vice President Pence is set to visit Jacksonville. And flooded out homeowners get a buyout from the city. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Charles Griggs, in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Give us a call now and join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, the cast of Ain't Misbehaving at the Alhambra Theater will be here. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome our roundtable guest, Nate Monroe, from the Florida Times Union.
Hey, good morning.
All right. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hey, how you doing?
Stephanie Brown from WOKV.
Good morning.
And Mike Mendenhall from the Jax Daily Record. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mike's a newbie here, so he's a little nervous. Lots to talk about this week, but our top story is a look back at the runoff election last Tuesday. Terrence Freeman and Tommy Hazuri won at large city council races, while Randy DeFore, Jacoby Pittman, and Brenda Plessy Jackson all won their runoffs for the district. The number to call is 549-2937. To get in on a conversation as we look back on that, AG, you've been following these races. What do you think about the results? Any surprises?
There weren't really surprises per se. I thought the race in 14 between DeFore and Gettinger was really close, and Gettinger had a really motivated street team where volunteers almost pushed her over the mayor's machine. That would have been an upset if it had happened. The other four races, they went as you would have expected. Pittman had the backing of Downtown Money. Hawley didn't make some of the attacks she could have against Pittman. That went as I would have expected. Priestley Jackson, she was a slam dunk from the outset. That wasn't a surprise. Terrence Freeman had the R plus seven universe behind him. It's Republican advantage, and that was a race that went party line. And Tommy Hazuri, you know, obviously had that crossover support. He had the name ID. Greg Rashaw was an unknown, and Hazuri was the rare Democratic win. The statewide Democratic Party tried to spin this as like a big win for them after it happened, but that was ridiculous. The statewide Democratic Party didn't really get much done. Hazuri got in on his own accord, and the two other Democrats that got elected did so versus other Democrats.
Yeah, Nate, a lot of people believe that Tommy Hazuri was going to pay a little price for his support of the mayor during the previous election. That didn't seem to matter. He really won large and handily. What are your thoughts on how the Democratic Party was sort of caught between a rock and a hard place on whether to support Tommy Hazuri or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think the price that Tommy had to pay was to have a runoff at all. He's someone who has been around long enough, and I think ordinarily might have closed out his reelection back in March. There was sort of a split vote that forced him to a runoff. Yeah, I mean, if you're a Democratic voter, you're sort of whatever the run-of-the-mill voter looks like in Jacksonville, those few proud people, they've seen Tommy Hazuri's name on a ballot for decades at this point. So that's not shocking at all.
Stephanie, what does this mean to the future of policy here in Jacksonville? It looks like the mayor's administration pretty much got all of the people who they wanted to have in place. How do you see that playing out for future policies going forward?
There are a fair amount of new faces that are obviously joining this city council when you consider March and then this May election that we had here. But overall, when you look at the composition, I would say fundamentally there's not a substantial change from what you had in this past city council to the one now. Maybe one seat flip toward the GOP. There's a few more women that are going to be on the city council overall. But substantially, when you consider kind of the tendencies that we've seen, the alliances that we've seen, I think in terms of the policy direction, Curry's likely to get some similar support that he did get for the last 4 years from the council that we had.
Mike, what do you see some of this outstanding potential policies or initiatives that are going to come out of this new council, all of these new members, people who are pretty much aligned with the administration?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of focus on downtown development. I think that's going to be a very big thing moving forward. The fact that they just redid the downtown overlay and rezoning, I think that's going to. I think you're going to see Mayor Curry really trying to push downtown development, and I think he probably has the council put in place to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting because most of the candidates, the winners from Tuesday night, I heard them all say pretty much the same thing. My primary focus is going to be public safety, downtown development, creating jobs. It almost sounded like they were all in lockstep with one, as AG would say, one machine. What do you think about that, AG? You see certain projects as well that will now go through that we're going to have some difficulty before?
Well, I think with downtown development projects, I think those are going to be easy. I think the devil's in some of the other details, such as the school board referendum. I think you're going to see some interesting coalitions and alliances there. You've got Matt Carlucci, who was elected in March that people forget about, but Carlucci has already opposed the administration on the landing plans and things like that. So you could see sort of a samizdat kind of opposition emerge on various issues. But, as we saw the last 4 years, those coalitions are ephemeral. They don't last forever. And, we'll see what happens. But I'm expecting Garrett Dennis, Brendan Priestley Jackson, people like that to run opposition to the mayor. The question is always, can they build coalitions and what do those coalitions look like? And can they ever get 10 votes for an issue?
I did hear also, it seemed like a lot of conciliatory talk. People were saying that they wanted to work together with all of the council members to make Jacksonville a better place. How long is that going to last, Nate?
I guess we'll see. I tend to agree with Stephanie that the outcome of the election probably does just ensure that, this kind of status quo that we're in is going to continue. I do think, though, that I think that this council, this incoming council, will be a bit more vocal than the previous council. We've got some outgoing veteran members who seem to have, phoned it in or something. And, we've had some really big issues come and go and without like really any public discussion about, sort of the merits of those ideas. I think we'll get a little bit more of that in this incoming council, even if the votes fall the same way.
Yeah. Who's in this group, the new group, Carlucci included, do you see as some emerging leaders? And some of these people are going to have right out of the bat, they're probably going to have significant roles in the upcoming committees from the new council leadership. Who do you see in this group that may be playing significant roles?
I think you naturally look to some of the newer councilmen on this last council that are retaining their seats. We had, for example, the finance chair this last time around, who was responsible for, and then we had a lot of vocal discussion about the Stop the Violence mini grants. The people who were behind those still on the council, we're likely to see them taking a pretty prominent role. You also have, again, some of those seasoned veterans. We have Tommy Hazuri, we have Matt Carlucci, while he's not on the council, has that prior council experience. So some of the people who are more comfortable in those roles likely to be vocal early on, but I think there's absolutely some space for some of these newcomers to kind of start to rise to the top, but it'll likely take time because if you think about some of the newer councils that are on the body right now, not a lot of them necessarily stand out as much as you might think for being as vocal as you might have expected. So I don't think anybody out of the gate I can put my finger on, but we'll give it a little time.
Yeah, we haven't talked a whole lot about the voter turnout, about 14%. Still the argument that this type of election needs to be on cycle with another major election. How does this bode for that future conversation, if it does at all? We were, early on to early voting, we were up to like 6%, and it didn't seem to get any better from there. Anybody want to?
Yeah. I mean, I look at this a different way. I like the off-year elections because I think you get more informed voters. I mean, the idea you get 60% turnout for a city election sounds great, but if they don't really know what they're voting on, and that would be the case if it was on a November 2020 ballot, for example, that could be worrisome. So there's a defense for the current cycle that is people at least care about what they're voting on. I did want to come back a little bit to how leadership on this council will emerge also. I mean, if you look at committee structure, generally speaking, the mayor's office has very strong input on who goes on to what committees. So when I look at somebody like Terrence Freeman, I see Terrence Freeman on finance, Randy DeFore, finance. I mean, basically anybody who is on finance or rules, you've got to assume is in a good place with the mayor's office. Somebody like Matt Carlucci, who's making noise, I could see him being marginalized in his first term the way Tommy Azzurri was. I mean, Tommy Azzurri had to pay the price to basically get in good with the mayor. And, you know, Azzurri's payoff comes this term. He's going to be vice president in July. He's on track for the council presidency as long as he doesn't get out of line with the mayor's office. So, you know, that's really how it's going to work. I mean, Scott Wilson's going to be the incoming council president. And Scott Wilson's a great guy, but he's not going to buck the mayor's office the way Anna Brochet did with committee assignments.
Well, how would that vote? Again, I'm going to go back to the party, because if Tommy Azzurri is playing a role so he can assume a leadership role, if you're the Democratic Party, you got to put some pressure
these,
on him
for to be a leader. These parties are useless here. I mean, both these parties in their ways.
And that leads us into Nate's article. Nate, you penned an article earlier this week that talked about how the demise of the Democratic Party, there was a lot of banter back and forth about, you know, the truisms about that. You know, talk a little bit about why you believe that this party has some catching up to do.
Well, I mean, over the last decade, there have been as many Democratic elected officials federally indicted as Democratic officials who have won citywide office. Two of those Democratic officials who have won citywide office, one, Tommy Azzurri, is estranged from the party. The second, Kimberly Daniels, is not really a Democrat at all. She's like to the right of Genghis Khan on most issues. And two of those indicted Democratic officials, one was the most high-profile Democrat in Jacksonville, Kareem Brown. The other was their, at one point, most promising rising star, Reggie Fullwood. He's a former state rep. I mean, I think that essentially says it right there. I mean, this party is not winning elections that matter. There have been a few races in the last year that have been really close. The District 14 council race being one with Sonny Gettinger, and Tracy Polson ran a very competitive race for state house in a district that should have been less friendly to a Democrat. But like, those are, you know, there aren't moral victories in politics. And you know, I'm not here to advise the Democratic Party on how to get better. But, you know, as someone who has to pay attention to this stuff, I can just tell you it's not looking good.
Okay. The number to call is 549-2937. We're discussing the Tuesday's election results and the upcoming new city council members who are been voted into office. We have a caller on the line. I'm going to punch him up. Good morning. Scott is on the line. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your question.
Yes. Yes, my question, it's the same thing that Nate was just talking about. My concern is for the African-American leadership here. Which most of them are Democratic Party, they are never able to move the needle forward for the Democratic Party. And right now, the Democratic Party is in bad shape. I don't know if they're going to be able to recover for the next 8 years. And that's my main concern, especially with the African-American leadership. Why the African-American leadership is not able to change any conditions in the African-American community? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Scott. We've had obviously significant turnover because of this election. We've had significant turnover in African-American community elected officials. Sam Newby and Garrett Dennis are the only two that remain that were elected previously. What does that mean, Mike, to leadership, as the caller mentioned?
I guess I would say that it definitely takes down on inside of a certain demographic in Jacksonville. I believe that especially when you're talking about, like, say, input on the development of the La Villa neighborhood. I mean, you definitely want to have that voice involved in the conversation.
Well, I also, to Nate's point, is that most of those people, I think it's all of them, were African-American Democrats who were indicted.
Yeah.
Right. And so that is pretty much the strength of the party, comes from, you know, black voters, and the Democratic Party seems to, you know, tends to realize that, or at least if they haven't, they should. Right. But, and the fact that these people have been indicted and are no longer part of the political power structure for the Democrats, it will, you know, sort of leave that vacuum and new power has to emerge.
I do want to push back just a tiny bit, though, because what we're doing is kind of equating African-American leadership and Democratic leadership. What's interesting is when you talk about Samuel Nuby, for example, he's a Republican. Terrence Freeman, he's a Republican as well. You do obviously have a large, the majority of the African-Americans who are serving on the city council are Democratic, but I just, you look back at the votes that have happened in recent years and how many of them are really falling on a party line, so to speak. With the occasional social issue that's emerged, there are a lot of the party politics that will come into play. But when you look at the city council and really how it's been structured and how it's been working, I just question if the party alignment means quite as much as, for example, maybe racial backgrounds and, you know, the urban core issues and those kind of alignments.
So, yeah, that's a great point. And I know that we've had this conversation here in the program previously about how the infrastructure of Jacksonville, especially in the Northwest area, has been left behind since consolidation. And the fact that those leaders, those elected officials, have not been able to reconcile that with whatever administration's been in office to get those things done, to catch those communities up. So this is another time, this is another one of those situations where we're gonna have to see how those elected officials step up and get those basic needs taken care of.
Yeah, you know, I look at it a little bit differently than that though. I mean, when you look at Nuby, you look at Freeman, these are machine candidates. I mean, these are people who are lifted up by Mayor Curry's political machine. Terrence Freeman was appointed by Rick Scott. You know, so for that matter, was Democrat Jacoby Pittman back in 2018, replaced two other indicted Democrats. You know, that being said, when you look at the urban core issues, you do see sort of Sam Nuby rise up with the 7 through 10 people. But Terrence Freeman thus far has sort of not been there to the same degree. I mean, Freeman's walked a more careful path. He did get some infrastructure in District 10 when he was serving over there. We'll see what he does as at large. But, you know, I look at somebody like Joyce Morgan to take a leadership role. We haven't mentioned her at all in this program, but Joyce Morgan got reelected. She's taking a leadership role in the cannabis issue and other things. And, you know, she's going to be a force. It's just a question of what that looks like. And I'm looking for a coalition to be built on some of these infrastructure issues, at least until the economy turns.
Okay. And we have a caller on the line. Caller, good morning, Terry. Terry's on the line.
Good morning. How are you?
All right.
When y'all were talking earlier about maybe moving the elections to to the state cycle, they were originally set up as municipal elections, and we took that off cycle so there could be a more focus on those. If you go back and look at the unitary elections, Ms. Fowler, Tilly Fowler, was on the council at the time, and we were trying to get away from the partisan primaries and go to a, like most, 99% of all the municipal elections are nonpartisan, and we were trying to get there. At the time, we were going to have the first election and the second election, and there weren't going to be party indications. That the parties came to us and said that part of the filing fee that went to the parties was one of their major fundraisers back then, or how they got their money. And so the compromise was to put an R&D after the candidates' names. Now you're telling me that the mayor has major influence on who's going to sit on the finance committee? Shame on whoever the president of the council is that day. That would never happen a few years ago before term limits. That would have never happened. But the rules committee and the finance committee is totally at the discretion of the president of the council, and there shouldn't be influences like that. Y'all are talking like this is an extension of the mayor's cabinet, and that's totally against the whole concept of checks and balances that went into the original consolidation. I wish we could get back. There isn't a Republican or Democratic pothole in this city, and we need to move away from any party designation to get back to nonpartisan elections at the level.
Thank you. Thank you for that, caller. Nate, you want to weigh in on the fact that we don't, you know, that there's independence between the council and the administration?
Yeah, I mean, there basically hasn't been, for the most part, it has just operated like an executive department. And the issue of nonpartisan elections, I mean, in theory, that would be wonderful. But, you know, the horse is at the barn door. I mean, like, that's, we're never going back to that. You know, this is the most partisan mayor we've had in the history of consolidated government. And the trajectory of politics generally has been in this direction anyway. I just don't think Jacksonville is going to reverse course on that.
Yeah, it's really... It's local now, but it, of course, it's been statewide and in and out, you know, it's federal as well. So whoever the party in power is the one who gets to make all the rules. And it's almost an extension across all branches of government. I think people understand that. And like you said, the horse is out of the barn now, and it would take, you know, some type of political miracle to find that type of cohesive independence, as you would say, where people worked across the aisle like they did before. So that's just the reality of politics. And the more people understand that, perhaps better we'll be able to work together.
And whether or not the label is on the ballot, you have to believe that, you know, people are going to campaign on their core issues, their beliefs, their alliances, what they would fight for. So whether or not you actually put the party label on the ballot, I understand that might influence the people who aren't doing the research ahead of time and are going to go and, you know, choose the ballot the last second, who has the D and who has the R. But if you take away those labels, then maybe you just lose those people. And then we have the turnout even lower. It's, you know, the voters who are educated are going to figure out where the alliances are regardless.
Yeah. Well, you know, St. Petersburg has nonpartisan mayor's race. And when the incumbent ran for reelection, he's a progressive Democrat. He had a pretty strong challenger, a Republican, and he sort of like a reverse of the dynamic here. He painted the Republican as like this Trump supporting, you know, crazy conservative, and it turned it into a partisan race anyway. So to Stephanie's point, like you can take the party labels off the ballot, but that doesn't mean that the campaigning isn't just going to be basically identical.
Yeah. And it's all about messages anyway. I mean, people are, they respond to what their personal situation is, and they respond to those types of candidates that are going to support their personal situations. Okay. So I wanted to go ahead and shift gears here. We're also making the headlines. Vice President Mike Pence is coming to town on Monday trying to drum up support for the revamped U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. Florida isn't home to any automobile assembly plants or anything like that, but we do have a significant amount of aviation manufacturing going on here. Florida's an important place for the president and his agenda, and so dispatching Mike Pence here is a way to kind of quell criticism, so to speak, of the tariffs.
Well, yeah, that and the fact that this is an easy media market for Mike Pence. That's why Mike Pence keeps coming here. He came here during the campaign to go to First Baptist Church. He came here to sell the repeal and replace of Obamacare. He came here to sell Ron DeSantis. And now he's here again for the fourth time in a few years. And that's because he knows that when he gets questions from the local media, they're going to be easy softball questions. He's not going to get questions about tough national issues. He'll get on-topic questions. They'll be respectful. He'll get good sound bites and good coverage. So the reason they send people here, the reason Mike Pence comes here, the reason Ron DeSantis comes here to launch things, the reason Rick Scott comes here, because it's like a homecoming game, because they don't respect the local press.
Wow. So is there any substance to the actual policy he's coming here to champion, Stephanie?
So with this policy, we're at a point where they are trying to build momentum, because this is not anything that the House of Representatives has shown they're willing to take up anytime soon. This is a trade agreement that still needs to be approved by Congress. And ultimately, with everything else that's facing Congress and the maybe more easy to digest issues that they can act on and really build around or rally around, that's what they're going to keep their focus on, especially as you move into the next election cycle. It's a little bit more difficult to explain to people why this tariff and this tax and this import might ultimately trickle down and have some sort of impact on you within the next few years. But it's more easy and substantial and, quite frankly, a partisan rallying cry if you're looking at something like immigration reform that is much easier to build your partisan coalition around. So as we get closer to 2020, the House so far not showing any indication that it's going to take this up anytime soon. And I don't really know if that's going to change.
But it almost seems like, Nate, that the economists have been saying that the tariffs have been having a negative impact on certain areas of the economy, especially in those rural areas, those farmers. And to come to Florida during that time, instead of going to those areas that have been heavily impacted, like AG said, is really a softball for them.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this, though. The entire reason that the Jacksonville Port Authority is dredging the St. Johns River is because of this projection that the Asian trade routes are going to grow. That is like the really hot thing for ports. Everyone wants a piece of the Asian trade market. And Donald Trump has, estranged us from Asian trading partners, namely China, during his entire administration, but is also helping to fund projects like this dredging. It just seems like this really inane, weird policy that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I would have to think that, folks over at Jacksport kind of wince when they see the president, sort of screwing up our trade partnerships.
Yeah, Mike, they call it tough negotiating. How long can people hold out? Because we've got folks that are, from what I understand, that are going bankrupt. They're really taking a risk. They're being subsidized by the government because they're not getting, doing the business, the trade business that they used to have. But how long do people get to hold out and before they say, Uncle, we want you to do something different?
We're getting closer and closer to that breaking point, I think. I mean, I think President Trump has been able to maintain a base of support up until this point. But particularly in the Midwest, you've got a lot of farmers who have been supportive of President Trump's policies thus far. They're really starting to take a hit with both the tariffs and the USMCA. It's a big issue for them. So China is currently the number two importer of U.S. soybeans, and even though there's been some negotiations there to try to purchase some of that, it's really been tough for those farmers losing that market. And kind of to Nate's point, talking about Jacksport, one of the things that Jacksport's trying to kind of sell is that the diversification of their container business will actually maybe mitigate some of this some of a hit that their revenues could take on tariffs, but right now the China is actually their number two trading partner when it comes to their container business. It's about 8-9% of their container business. So that's, I mean, even if they can, mitigate and weather that somewhat, you're still talking about a potential issue.
Yeah. I know, AG, this is a photo op, but do voters in Florida really understand the impacts of tariffs on the rest of the economy?
I think they do when they feel it in their pocketbook. Do they understand it in an academic way? No, but I think when people are paying more at the store, when they have less discretionary income, and look at this in the context of a larger global economic slowdown. China's seeing slowdowns right now on this end. We're basically been priming the pump for 10 years to keep things going with the world's longest, slowest recovery that never actually reached people below the top 1%. These are the issues we're running into. So yeah, this is a photo op and people are going to feel the tariffs. And Mike Pence can visit 26 cities as he plans to with this tour, but it's not going to make a whit of difference because the larger issues are structural and they're macroeconomic.
So if we look at Mike Pence coming to Jacksonville to sort of shore up the PR on how the future impact of successful tariffs and trade with China, how does that really impact local economy for Jacksonville? I know we know about the port, but there are some things going on here that people really don't. I mean, people have been saying they're wondering if gas prices are going to be impacted. They're going to wonder if the next time they purchase goods and services, are they going to be impacted? And so if that's the case, then how long before people started raise up and say, hey, we don't want to see you in Florida anymore. We're ready to vote you out.
Well, I really think the small manufacturers in Jacksonville are the ones that are going to that are really going to suffer on this one. When you talk about supply chains, a lot of them have been getting raw materials from China at a pretty significantly low cost for years. And so those are the businesses that are probably going to be feeling it the most. And it sometimes it takes like 18 to 24 months to find a new supplier and get contracts signed. So that's really where I think the Jacksonville area businesses are going to be hurt the most.
Okay. So also making the headlines this week, the city of Jacksonville is moving ahead with a plan to spend $4.5 million to buy out and demolish 17 homes in South Shore's neighborhood on the South Bank between St. Nicholas and San Marco. The homes were inundated after Hurricane Irma 2 years ago, and they are located in a 100-year floodplain. Now, at the same time, Jacksonville Storm Resiliency Committee it looks poised to recommend several changes to the city development rules that members hope will improve drainage and reduce flooding. So, AG, is this a good plan? This resiliency committee is going to spend this money to get this done and hopefully never, ever, ever develop on this property again. The residents seem to believe that this is a good idea, but there still may be some holdouts.
It's a good idea for those people. It's a good idea for those 17 people who are getting $200,000 for homes in a floodplain. Is it a sustainable policy for the rest of the city? I don't think so. That was something that Lori Boyer pushed through, and Lori Boyer has been very powerful in the council the second term. I don't think this is a solution that will apply it down the road, and I think the long-range resiliency issues are the ones we need to be watching. But the idea that the city can just give $200,000 to a homeowner because they're in low-lying area, I don't think that's sustainable, especially when we see the economic downturn, especially when we see decline in millage connections that's bound to happen in the next few years.
Wouldn't there be other areas of town that meet the same criteria as this particular floodplain?
Yeah, without a doubt. And increasingly so as we see the effects of sea level rise get more intense. I mean, look, like this stuff is a fine start. Like, I'm not going to say that the city taking a look at, zoning regulations to address sea level rise is a bad thing. Like, it's good they're doing this. It seems like it's a few years late. And I continue to be a little bit baffled, like how a city like St. Augustine is farther ahead on this than Jacksonville. I mean, look, St. Augustine asked the Army Corps to do a flood study of the city. They're putting up money to pay for it. I don't understand why Jacksonville cannot ask the Army Corps to do a flood study. I mean, part of the problem is that we don't even have a really good handle on flooding problems sort of in a bigger picture in this town.
The Resiliency Committee, Stephanie, is really looking at other mitigation opportunities. Is this really about climate change, and where does that discussion come into play? Because there has to be some real activity going on that's going to address the core problem.
I think regardless of what you say the root cause might be, the effects are real. The flooding and, mitigation efforts that need to take place, whatever you want to blame it on, it's a very real reality for people who live in the neighborhoods that we know traditionally and historically flood and will continue to do so. So you see a step like this, and it may be an effective step in some of those less populated areas. You don't see that in, the hundreds, if not thousands of homes that line the river, because it's not practical to try to just buy people out, in those areas. That's where you need to go in with that infrastructure and with that change. And so, we've seen piecemeal steps here or there. We know they're, starting to really take this seriously. So again, it just comes down to, whatever the core may be, this committee, whatever comes out of it and subsequent years, now is the time that they really need to be addressing the very real impact.
Yeah. The number to call is 549-2937. If you want to get in on the conversation, we're talking about right now, we're discussing the city's plan to purchase property in floodplain areas, low-lying areas that have been impacted by Hurricane Irma. Mike, if this goes on and we know that, like AG said, this probably is not sustainable, what type of plans do you see on the horizon that the city could come up with in order to mitigate this problem for other communities?
That's the real question, isn't it? I don't think at this point there is too much of a plan. AG, maybe you could respond to that a little bit more thoroughly.
In terms of the city's plan, I mean, you got to look at capital budgets over the next few years. You know, what we've seen the last few years is we've seen some discretionary capital because of the pension reform. You know, that's going to reverse, you know, as time goes on, because, you know, pension costs will rise up again. Equity markets are going to go down again. So, you know, any plans that come out, you've got to have money to fulfill them. And I don't know if there are guarantees beyond the next budget or two that things can be done. And these are long-range solutions. So like so many solutions in the city, they are contingent upon an economic cycle.
Well, I mean, I think we're looking at the plan. It's this committee and this buyout program. Like, there is no other... unless there's some secret that no one's being told, like, this is the totality of the city's response to sea level rise right now.
Yeah, the buyout plan is, the money is there as part of some federal dollars initially, but at some particular point that money is going to run out, and there has to be some type of sustainable core plan to deal with this, because it's not going away. It looks like as we continue to have, you know, these intense hurricane seasons or storms, you know, we're going to continue to see more and more low-lying areas that need to be addressed, and they'll fall under the city's resiliency, you know, program, or at least be reviewed by the committee.
Yeah, I mean, the city's not going to turn San Marco back into a floodplain. Like, that's, you know, but that's, I mean, that entire area is flood prone. We see daytime flooding, especially in the fall in San Marco. It's going to be a huge issue going forward.
What about those people who don't want to relocate? And we've heard that there are some people who are, you know, going to be, this is not mandatory. It's, you know, people can, they don't have to accept the payment, the buyout from the city. And if they decide to stay, you know, how is that going to impact, you know, the future of people staying in these particular low-lying areas?
You know, I'll never forget when I was early on in Jacksonville, it was Debbie and Beryl were the storms that came through. And I spent a lot of time on Black Creek in Middleburg. And if you talk about, you know, just systemic flooding, that is, you know, one of the key areas. And the people who lived there were dealing with record flooding, just, you know, feet and feet and feet, lost everything, had to rebuild their homes. And every single one of them told me, but that's just life on the creek. Yeah. And that's what we want to do. So there absolutely will be people in Jacksonville as well that know flooding is going to happen time and time again. I think in that area, especially, and maybe in some of these more historically flood prone areas, you will start to see maybe building codes change, because in Middleburg, for example, now most of the buildings have cement concrete on that bottom floor, and it's, or they're on stilts and elevated, not to say that we're going to build stilts in San Marco, but you may start to see that be one of the more the steps that take place as some homes kind of age out. Maybe we build them to a new structure that is more sustainable if you have somewhere that deals with a lot of flooding.
It almost sounds like people don't have any business living on. They can live where they want to, but they're taking the risk to live in these areas where they know eventually they may have problems. Is it fair to ask the city or anyone else to you know, to help sort of mitigate that problem when something occurs?
I don't think fairness has much to do with it. It's political expediency. The people on South Shores, they mobilized. They got the councilwoman's attention. They got a deal. Now, if you don't have a Lori Boyer or somebody of that stature representing you, you may not get the same deal. And we can think of many people in that council who don't have that stroke, don't have that wherewithal, don't know how to work the system. So I don't think you're going to see a bunch of South Shores around the city. I think that was a specialized case.
I also think there are serious discussions in the federal level about reforming a national flood insurance program to stop rebuilding homes that flood again and again and again. That is a larger issue, and it doesn't just affect Jacksonville. There are definitely a lot of serious discussions about that that should happen.
Okay. And there is an important caveat here, too, which is, remember, this came specifically out of Irma, which unlocked those federal dollars. You don't have those for just a thunderstorm flooding that may take place in the city. So it's not clear that this would be a practical step or even a step they're considering in the more flood-prone areas that they don't have those FEMA dollars accessible for.
Okay. The number to call is 549-2937 as we move along to our other topics in the news this week. Lori Boyer is the new CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. Boyer, who's leaving the city council, beat out two other finalists from out of town. So while Boyer has never worked for a downtown development agency, the board was still impressed with her resume as well as her familiarity with downtown and the political landscape. So, Mike, you've been at those interviews. Tell us, what did you see? How were the other candidates, and what did you think about the process?
Well, first of all, I mean, Lori Boyer's been the council liaison to the DIA for quite a long time. So, I mean, they were incredibly familiar with her. And I mean, there were even moments in the city council meeting where some of the other council members were kind of joking with her when she was working on the downtown overlay project that they expect to see great things out of her moving forward at the DIA. So, but I mean, there were 3 hours of interviews. Each candidate had an hour to kind of plead their case. One of the things that Greg Felisrum, who was one of the candidates, he was the vice president of the Economic Development Authority in Kansas City. They really liked the fact that he wanted he had a plan to market the city of Jacksonville. And that's one of the things that they actually asked Lori Boyer about during the interview process that I felt was true questions. Otherwise, I think, Councilmember Boyer has impressed that DIA board, and it was I think the writing was on the wall for her hire.
Yeah, this one's been in the making for a while, the AG, huh?
It was like our JA board CEO, where you had the two out of town candidates who are basically there as plants, and then you have like the inside candidate who wins all along. But yeah, I mean, Boyer's going to represent continuity, and really that's what the administration wanted more than anything, I think, is continuity. Now, that being said, Boyer cannot represent the DIA in front of council for 2 years. That was a sticking point. That was something that the Florida Commission on Ethics decided earlier this year. And so Boyer's going to have to find a workaround to actually talk to the council, because she can't lobby her former legislative body. But I'm sure a workaround will be found. They always are.
While she had a good resume, did anybody have any outside of the circle have any objections to this appointment? I mean, she has been liaison. She's been great with downtown. This was probably one of the worst kept secrets, except it wasn't a secret, that we've seen in local politics in a while. Nate, does anyone have any problem with their appointment, and they just feel like this is probably good for continuity?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like a little bit, in some respects, like inside baseball to, you know, garner much outside scrutiny. Honestly, if the DIA is going to act the way it has the last 2 years, where it just sort of in lockstep with the mayor's office on everything, it doesn't really matter who's running it. So, yeah, everyone loves Lori. I guess we'll see.
Mm-hmm. I think an important strength that she brings to the table is just her ability to communicate these complex issues. When you're talking about zoning overlays and TIF funding and all of these complex city matters, to really explain that clearly and concisely to the public, to the board, to the stakeholders, that's something she's shown an ability to do while she's been on the city council. And I think with all of the downtown projects that are facing us, it's going to be an important asset that board will have with her as the CEO.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air. John from the South Side.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. You know, just getting back to the South Shores, you know, I just want to, you know, throw this out there. You know, 2013-380, you know, that was the legislation that created a maritime management plan. And to allude to the fact that there's a bailout right now, your one call panelist alluded to that, you know, you have federal funds. So it's like use it or lose it. But you're right next to the district property. And I think what you're going to see is once these houses are bulldozed down, then when you develop that property, you're going to see the elevation of that land increase tremendously.
I appreciate that, John. John, we appreciate your call, but we're running short on time. So I'm going to have to cut you off there, and I'm going to have to thank our panel for being with us today. Thanks to Stephanie Brown, Mike Mendenhall, A.G. Gankarski, and Nate Monroe. Thanks for a lively discussion. It's been great hosting you all here for my first time hosting this portion of the show. And have a great weekend. We'll be right back on First Coast Connect with Ain't Misbehaving.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk.
Comcast Business, providing a gig speed network and gig-fueled applications that can help your business go beyond. Learn more at ComcastBusiness.com. Comcast Business, beyond fast. Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. When crossing traffic lanes, be on the lookout for motorcyclists. for everyone's sake. The seconds you use to look might save a life. Learn more at waynehogan.law.
The Russians hacking into Florida's election systems. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
This Friday, not one but two Florida counties had their voting databases hacked, but the FBI won't say which two. And Alabama approves the nation's most restrictive abortion law. What could it mean for efforts here in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Friday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatto. This week on Science Friday, what makes a scream a scream? And what's the difference between a scared shriek and a happy holler? Plus, students competing for the top prize at Intel's International Science and Engineering Fair. They're scary smart. It's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
President Trump gives Hungary's controversial prime minister a warm welcome. The White House turns up the heat against the Chinese tech giant Huawei, and Tehran tells Washington to cool it.
We are not interested in war. We are not planning for a war. War is not an option for Iran.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
To talk with all by myself, no one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you.
All right, welcome back. And finally, this hour in the 1920s and 30s, Harlem was the epicenter of the music world. It was a time when Manhattan nightclubs like the Cotton Club and the Savoy Ballroom were the playgrounds of high society, and Lenox Avenue Drive were filled with piano players banging out the new beat known as swing. Among the great composers to come out of that era was Thomas Fats Waller, writer of more than 400 songs and inductee into the Grammy Hall of Fame. Ain't Misbehavin', on stage now at the Alhambra Theater, is a tribute to the Harlem Renaissance, an era of growing creativity, culturally awareness, ethnic pride, and takes its title from the 1929 Waller song, Ain't Misbehavin'. The cast of Ain't Misbehavin' joins us now in studio, and welcome everyone.
Welcome.
Hi. Hi.
All right. Thanks so for much. Being here. So tell us about the play. I want to know when you're going to be performing at the Alhambra, and tell us a little bit about the play and what's the theme behind it.
Well, first of all, I'm Tara Connor Jones. I'm playing the role of Nell in Ain't Misbehavin'. Okay. The show is a tribute to the music of the Harlem Renaissance, the musicians of that time from the 20s and 30s. Fats Waller was an incredible musician, and this show celebrates who he was as a musician. It's beautiful music. It's at the Alhambra now through June 9th. If you need tickets, and we need all of you to need tickets for you and your family and your enemies,
yes.
www.alhambrajacks.com.
Okay. Fats Waller was an incredible composer. Talk about what this play means to his compositions.
Well, yeah, Fats was an early musician. He was the seventh child of 11 kids. His mom was a musician. His dad was a preacher by the weekend and a truck driver during the weekdays to support all of those 11 children.
Yes.
But Fats Waller's career started very early. He was a piano player at 6 and organist by the time he was 15, and he made his first recording at 18 with RCA Victor Recording. His first song was published at 18. So it's a collection of all his music that he wrote. Richard Malby conceived the show to conceive all of the music of Fats Waller. Now, all the music, there's no book, as you would say, per show for this show. There's no book show. It's just a collection of all his music. But each song is driven with drama, comedy,
dance,
scandal, dance. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those family shows that you come out and it's just one hit after the other. Your foot start thumping and tapping along from beginning to end. So it's a collection and celebration of his work. Each character is, there's five characters in it, and my character, I'm Manny Cadet. I would probably, and in the show is named after the original cast members. So I would play the Ken character, who's known to be the Fats Waller character. The Andre character is seemingly supposed to be his writer, Ratsvi, who wrote with him. And then the three ladies that join the cast are typically supposed to be two of Fats's wives. And then the third is his side piece or mistress, as you would call it. Thomas was a gregarious, fun, lively character who was extremely popular in the 30s with his music. He was the architect of modern jazz. Mm-hmm. His piano playing was known as stride piano, where your right hand carried the melody and the left hand carried the tricks or the rhythm of that. But he was known as the godfather or the architect of modern jazz.
What's it like performing in the play like this? It sounds like a lot of energy. It sounds like a lot of fun to play in that, to play these roles. What's it like?
It is a party every night that we're on stage. It's such a good time, and it's a very engaging show, and we love to involve the audience. We like them to come on a ride and a trip with us through music. And through the music of Fats Waller.
Okay. We only have a few more minutes, but I'd like to, if you would, do you have a moment to kind of give us a little taste of what we're going to hear on the show?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. We'd like to sing the title song, actually.
Okay. Ain't Misbehavin'.
All right, we're ready? All right, here we go.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation. I mean the shelf. Ain't misbehaving. I'm saving my love for you. And you. And you. Oh, and you.
I know for certain the one I love. I ain't through with flirting. It's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving. I'm saving my love for you. Oh, hi, Daddy.
Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kiss is all I was waiting for, believe me.
I don't stay out late.
I don't play to go.
I'm home about 8, just me and my neighbor's radio, I can't afford.
Hey, misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you,
saving my love just for you.
No one to walk with all by myself. No one to talk with but hoo-ha, she's nobody. She's just a little girl, came by to drop off some Girl Scout cookies.
Hey, misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you.
I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that...
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.